Previously on Beta.
Come out and take it, you dirty yellow-bellied rat, or I'll give it to you through the door.
No, no cook, Betsy.
Who are you talking to?
Grandma. She's lonesome. She wanted to know if I can come stay with her.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, director Andrew Renzi joins us to talk about his Netflix docuseries, Pepsi, Where's My Jet?
I have not talked to a lawyer yet about anything randomly and brought this up to them and had them not say, I studied this in college, in law school.
Also, Wisconsin's own Wendy Wimmer on her debut short story collection, Entry Level.
I would describe it as scary, funny, sad, like with slashes.
But first, Michael Imperioli. You probably remember him for his outstanding portrayal of Tony Soprano's protege, Christopher Moltisanti, on The Sopranos. But Michael is not just an Emmy Award-winning actor. He was also the only Sopranos cast member to join creator David Chase's writing room. He wrote several popular episodes of the show, and writing is still in his blood. Michael has just released his debut novel. It's called The Perfume Burned His Eyes. The novel takes place in New York in the 70s. It's about a Queens teenager named Matthew who moves to Manhattan. After having trouble adjusting, he finds help from an unlikely source. It turns out that rock icon Lou Reed lives in the very same building. Lou befriends Matthew and helps him find his way in a strange dynamic world. Michael has written a gripping, propulsive, and somewhat Salinger-esque novel. He joined us from his home in New York to talk about the book, his friendship with Lou Reed, and his love affair with writing.
I had made several attempts at fiction, mostly short stories, none of which were any good. But fiction had been a love of mine for quite a long time. And a friend of mine, who's also a fellow fiction writer, said to me one day, when are you going to write a novel? Like, I can't write a novel. And he said, no, you could write a novel. And for some bizarre reason, I actually believed him. And then when my middle child was 16, he was going through the usual and unusual 16-year-old things. And I wanted to find a way to relate to that mind. So I started writing this coming-of-age story. And this was mid-2013. And I set it in New York in the 70s out of a fondness for the era, really. I was 11 when this story kind of starts. And I started writing. And then in October that year, Lou Reed died. And which hit me on a number of levels. As a fan, as an artist, as a New Yorker, and as a friend, because I got to be friendly with Lou in the last dozen years of his life. And I had been in touch with him a little bit in the last month of his life. And somehow I got the idea of, okay, the kid moves from Queens to New York and he lives in Lou's building in 1977. And that was how it started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned earlier that part of the reason you were inspired to write this novel was to kind of get in touch with your middle son, who was 16 at the time. I'm curious to know, has he read your novel?
Yeah, he was one of the first readers outside of my wife, and he liked it a lot.
That's great to hear. And why wouldn't he like it a lot? It's a great novel. After you talked about this earlier, about Matthew and his mother moving from Jackson Heights, Queens, to Manhattan, and then Matthew discovers that Lou Reed lives in the same apartment building. You touched on it earlier, but I want to ask you more directly. Why did you decide to include Lou as a character in your book?
Mostly out of my great admiration for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been kind of a North Star for me in terms of navigating my own artistic life. And he became very important to me. And when he died, I really felt something had ended. Like an era had really ended for me and for New York and for the music world. And part of me liked the idea of spending time with him in my mind, you know, for quite a long time. And it was, I was correct in that impulse because I did enjoy having that, opening that space and being with him there, even though the Lou of 1977 was very different than the Lou that I finally befriended in 2001.
What was the difference between...
He was a raging drug addict, alcoholic in the 70s, to the point where he was really the rock star that everyone thought was going to die, more so than like Keith Richards. Lou was he was shooting Dizoxin, which is like an amphetamine I think they gave to like heart attack victims or something, you know, and he'd be up for days and all the psychosis that comes with that. And then in the 80s, he got married to his second wife, Sylvia Morales, and she helped him get sober and also started managing his career and moved him into this other stage of his life where he became very creative and started putting out some really mature works that were very relevant and really potent works of art, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you had this friendship with Lou Reed. Do you have a favorite memory of your friendship with him that you treasure and think about more than any other memory?
A very funny story. The first time I met Lou was way before we became friends. It was around 1991 or two. And I had lived in the Village since I was 21 or 22. Greenwich Village, where Lou lived at the time. And I would see him walking around the Village, you know, which was very odd seeing like your heroes just wandering around your same neighborhood that you lived in. But I never had the courage to approach him. And then one day I was at a Knicks game and Lou is at the Knicks game. And at the time I had just been cast in a movie called I Shot Andy Warhol. And I was playing Ondine, one of the Warhol superstars, who was also a very good friend of Lou Reed's. So I'm like, this is a great icebreaker. I can walk up to Lou, say, I'm a big fan, I'm playing one of your friends. Great way to open a conversation. The problem was, and I knew this was a risk, I Shot Andy Warhol was about Valerie Solanas, who shot and, you know, almost killed one of Lou's best friends, Andy Warhol. So I knew he wasn't happy. He had been vocal that he was not happy they were making this movie. But I took the risk and I went up to him and I said, my name is Michael, I'm an actor. I know... I just got cast in this movie. I know you're really not happy. They're making it. I Shot Andy Warhol. And he goes, I think it's despicable. They're making a movie about that psychotic bitch. I said, yeah, I know. But I'm doing it anyway. And I'm playing someone who you knew. His name was Ondine. And he went, good luck. And he turned away, walked away, and went on the escalator, which leads out of the garden. The game was over. And I was just devastated. I felt like such a fool, you know, and I'm on the escalator and he's several steps ahead of me and he looks over his shoulder and he looks back at me a couple of times and he waves me over to him. And I walked up to him and he put his arm around me and said, listen, work hard, do a good job. And just remember one thing, he was very funny. And that was it. And in some ways, that little scene really was a seed and a germ for the relationship between Matthew and Lou in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The artist and musician Laurie Anderson was married to Lou Reed for 5 years. Has she read your novel?
Yeah, I read it to her before I published it, and I wrote to her and said that I was writing it. I wanted her to know from me that I was writing it, that it wasn't something is based in. I mean, the biographical background is true. He lived in that neighborhood in a building there with Rachel Humphreys and obviously was doing drugs. But the relationship and the events in the book are not true. Mm-hmm. And I said, I just want you to know I wrote this out of a place of love and admiration and respect. If you don't want to read it, I get it. If you do want to read it and want to share your thoughts, you can. If you read it and don't want to share your thoughts, that's fine. But I just wanted you to know that I'm doing it and where it comes from. I would not have published it while he was alive. Hmm. And she read it and she wrote back and she said she liked it. She said she saw some Louisms, but she said, to be honest, I didn't know Lou at that time.
Right.
So to me, you know, that character was very different than the Lou that I know. I didn't know that character. But his second wife, Laurie was his third wife. His second wife, Sylvia Morales, did know him at that time. And kind of thought, was under the impression that it was a true story.
Are you happier as a brunette? Are you happier as a schmuck?
I'm no schmuck.
I'm no brunette.
You were blonde last time, though.
No, I wasn't.
You were?
I was a bleached blonde.
A bleached blonde.
Trashy blonde.
You looked younger as a blonde.
Well, you look older.
I'm not a blonde, though.
I know, it's worse.
Listen.
You don't stand a chance. You're going to dig your own grave.
I know, I'm not trying to fight you.
Well, ask us a nice, reasonable question instead of, you know, who do you date?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, but you were the only Sopranos cast member who wrote scripts for the show. How did David Chase's writing room compare to your novel writing experience?
One of the motivating factors towards writing a novel was I had had several, at least three or four TV series projects that were in various stages of development with studios and networks, but never made it to the air for a variety of different reasons. But most of it had to do with, having to find a way to make it fit into the network or studio's agenda. And I found it very, very frustrating.
You ever feel like nothing good was ever going to happen to you?
Yeah, and nothing did. So what? I'm alive. I'm surviving.
That's it. I don't want to just survive. It says in these movie writing books that every character has an arc. You understand? Like everybody starts out somewheres, and then they do something, or something gets done to them, changes their life. That's called their arc. Where's my arc?
But you know, screenplays and teleplays are not works unto themselves. They're blueprints, they're schematics. Once you make the actual show, they're worthless. And until you make the actual show, they're kind of worthless. And I said, well, if I write a book, it's an end unto itself. I mean, obviously you need a publisher to put it out, but the work itself is, that's the work. It's not waiting for some producer to greenlight it, to get a budget so you can cast it and hire a crew and shoot it and then edit it. It is the work. And most of my writing before that was very collaborative. TV and film is a very collaborative medium for a writer. And some of the projects I wrote in tandem with other writers. And there was something about the isolation and solitary qualities of writing a novel that at that time really appealed to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That makes sense. Speaking of The Sopranos, you launched a podcast which breaks down each episode. What has that experience been like?
We did that from April of 2020 till December of 21. Talking Sopranos podcast, which was an episode-by-episode rewatch. Steve Sharippa and I did it together. And neither one of us had watched The Sopranos since it went off the air in 2007. Hmm. And now we had to rewatch the entire series week by week. And not only watch it, but, I mean, I would take 20 pages of notes, you know.
Wow.
Every single pop culture reference, every song, every guest actor, locations. I would look up everything that went into that.
In the writer's room, you'll outline it together with the other writers or just one writer with
David. Oh, you will. So yeah. You had, so even though
I didn't with this episode.
Okay. What do you say your spec script that you turned in, how much do you think wind up being used?
Quite a bit, actually.
75%, 80%?
Maybe, because wow, the A story really is Christopher and the afterlife and the stuff with Paulie, all that stuff was in. Obviously, the stuff with hunting down Matt Bevilacqua, that wasn't in there. The vasectomy wasn't in there. So those were storylines that David had broken, and then he gave them to me, and then you go off with an outline and write a first draft.
And I was really, really blown away by how good it was and how well it held up. And the show and the podcast gave me a real new appreciation for it with some distance. Because when you're making it and you're involved in it, there's so many personal things that you don't have much of an objectivity because there's so much personal stuff involved in your involvement and how you're dealing with it and what you're doing. And this was with, 13 years of distance. And I was really able to kind of watch and understand why it has held up and has so many fans.
That's great to hear. Yeah. What's next for you? Any plans to write another novel?
I'm writing a few things. I am writing another novel.
Great.
About two-thirds the way into it.
Excellent.
I had to put it on hold for a couple other projects that came into my life. One is a TV pilot that I'm for HBO that I'm writing, and one is a film that I'm writing with David Chase. So those three things are in progress. My band has just finished recording a new album. We have to mix it this in a couple of weeks. And the paperback version of this, Perfume Burn His Eyes, comes out in tandem with a book of Zopa lyrics that Akashic, our publisher, is putting out at the same time as the paperback release.
Oh, cool. So lots to look forward to. Can you tell us anything about the HBO TV pilot or the film you're working on with David Chase? Or
the TV pilot is with Alec Berg, who's a writer, producer, director, one of the showrunners of Barry on HBO, and also wrote, produced Silicon Valley and wrote on Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And it's a half-hour dark comedy where I play myself, and it explores celebrity and my, you know, kind of my own journey into Buddhism and things like, and spirituality. The movie, David and I are writing it, and it would star myself and Steve Sciarrippa.
Excellent. Michael Imperioli, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. Congratulations on The Perfume Burned His Eyes. It's a great book, and looking forward to your future projects.
Thank you for having me today.
Michael Imperioli is a novelist, screenwriter, musician, and actor. His debut novel is called The Perfume Burned His Eyes. You can find out more about Michael and his book at wpr.org/beta.
There's very few people in the world that would take an idea from a 20-year-old that's as crazy as this and actually run with it. And so I just kind of like love the spirit of that, where it's like, Todd took a swing on this kid, and that's the spirit of this whole show.
Coming up, director Andrew Renzi on the Netflix docuseries, Pepsi, Where's My Jet? I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Director Andrew Renzi loves to track down stories that have some kind of special sauce, what he describes as a Trojan horse. And he may have found his biggest Trojan horse yet with the Netflix docuseries, Pepsi, Where's My Jet? The series follows a 1995 story about college student John Leonard and his quest to convince Pepsi to give him a Harrier jet, which was worth about $33 million. And why did John have the gall to do this? Because he noticed that there was no disclaimer in a Pepsi TV commercial. There was no fine print. So what was it about this strange but true story that captivated Andrew's interest?
I think the Trojan horse for me was really just the glitz of the 90s advertising world, and specifically Pepsi and what Pepsi meant at that time. We were entering kind of what was a golden age of advertising at that time, where suddenly, if you were a celebrity and you were on a commercial promoting a brand like Pepsi, it wasn't considered uncool. It wasn't selling out. Suddenly there was this weird transition where you could be David Bowie, the coolest celebrity in the world, and promoting Pepsi. And so I loved that time when it was like this huge shift where consumerism and advertising kind of became right front and center. You know, every Super Bowl, it was like, what celebrity is going to be promoting what brand? So I think the Trojan horse for this really was that time, that moment, the advertising kind of excessiveness and Pepsi specifically.
Mm-hmm. And you were only 11 when this whole story started in 1995. Were you like conscious of the Cola Wars back then?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just think that as a kid that was, I was growing up in the Philadelphia area, and, you know, and I loved sports. So it's like the Super Bowl would revolve around that. And I had a keen understanding of just kind of the film world. My dad really kind of raised me and loved movies. He was a real cinephile. He's an Italian guy that just like loved to introduce me to sort of old Italian films. And so I just kind of had like a sense of media, and I loved it. And it was something that was there for me. And then, you know, when you were a kid, I mean, if you hear about like, you know, John was a little older than I was, but you know, when you were a kid, the idea of the Pepsi generation was there for you. Like they were targeting us. They were targeting 11-year-olds. They were targeting 15-year-olds. So I can't say that, you know, cut to 25 years later and I sought this story out because I remembered the Harrier jet specifically. But I can tell you that as an 11-year-old, I'm sure I walked down the aisle at the grocery store and said, I want to buy a Pepsi if I can win a Harrier jet.
Mm, yeah, exactly. Very well said. How did you track down John Leonard?
Okay, so that was probably the thing that set this project in motion the most, because it was the most challenging part, but it was also kind of the most exciting part. And so I was sitting with my producer and my friend Andrew Corkin, and we were talking about this project like well over 2.5 years ago. And, you know, I was just like, gosh, we should try to find this guy. Like, how do we get to this guy? So, you know, I just started doing some internet sleuthing and some just kind of trying to figure this out. And I tracked down a phone number in Alaska, in Denali at the state park. And I was like, okay, I think this guy lives in Alaska. And I call this state park. This is after I'd sent 5 or 6 emails to some random addresses that I found online, and none of them came back to me. And so I call this place. This woman answers, and it's Denali State Park. And she's this, you know, hello. And I say, hi, I'm looking for John Leonard. And she's like, oh, like, can I ask what this is about? And I was like, oh, I'm a documentary filmmaker. And then she goes, this must be about the Pepsi story.
Introducing the new Pepsi Stuff catalog. Now, the more Pepsi you drink, the more great stuff you're going to get.
Sure beats the bus.
Play that again.
Sure beats the bus.
I looked at it, and I was completely dumbstruck.
No fine print. That is a legit offer. I don't care what anybody else says. I'm going to get that jet.
And she is this like wonderful woman in Denali. And I was like, okay, it is. And she was like, listen, I can't give you his contact, but I can tell you that I can tell him that you called. And so I, you know, wait. A couple weeks later, I actually get an email back, and he was basically like, you're persistent. I really appreciate that. I never really wanted to tell this story again. I've moved on from this, but this sounds interesting. And so, you know, we struck up conversations from there. And then I met Todd. And once I met Todd, it kind of all clicked, where I was like, the whole story here is so much less about this actual case from the 90s and so much more about this friendship between these two people. And I just like loved how universal that felt.
Our first trip together, we sat through a number of storms. And if you stay in the tent shoulder to shoulder for 7 straight days, you talk about a lot of stuff.
After I met Todd, I was like, everyone needs a Todd in their life. This guy is just like such a wonderful addition to anybody's life.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you're right. And he's a big part of what makes the docuseries work so well. And he joins John's quest for a free Harrier jet. Can you tell us a bit about their friendship?
Yeah. So, you know, I learned a lot about mountain climbing in the process of making this show. And I think that their friendship is really boiled down to kind of that wonderful thing that happens on the mountain, where if you're a 20-year-old kid and you're helping a man who's much older than you, who had just come off of a brain tumor, get up Denali, the idea of age and like success and all those things just goes out the window and you become equals. And so I think that their friendship was really based on this kind of mutual need of one another, where Todd represented this guy that was like worldly and knew a lot about the world and had a lot of success. And John represented somebody that was like helping Todd pursue this dream that he wanted to do and get back on his feet and really kind of become whole again. And so the foundation of the friendship was just so incredible. And then to go off of that, not to mention, it's like there's very few people in the world that would take an idea from a 20-year-old that's as crazy as this and actually run with it. And so I just kind of like love the spirit of that, where it's like Todd took a swing on this kid, and that's the spirit of this whole show.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How did John and Todd work together to try to get Pepsi to cough up the free Harrier jet?
Well, at first, John put together this pretty ridiculous, half-baked, quite frankly, kind of stupid plan to try to get enough points to do it, which would be like buying millions and millions of dollars of Pepsi and filling up warehouses. And he did this actual business plan where he was like, let's do this, Todd.
It was a multi-million dollar business deal to go out and acquire all of the points. And to acquire the points, it spelled out labor costs, transportation costs, storage costs. And at the time, it would
cost?
$4.3 million.
And I go, what?
So each 12-pack was worth 5 points. I need to buy 1.4 million 12-packs to get to 7 million points. That's over 16 million cans of Pepsi.
And Todd was kind of just humoring him, letting him go along for the ride, and just basically like teaching this kid a lesson almost. And so at the end of the day, John presents this business plan. He's like, let's spend $4 million to get enough Pepsi to put it all in warehouses and then go get the points. And Todd was like, well, what if we buy all this Pepsi and then the prize goes away, the sweepstakes ends, we get $3.9 million worth of Pepsi and we can't get the $4 million. And so there was just so many holes in this plan. And it was right when John thought he was defeated that he found the fine print. And he realized that Pepsi had this kind of crazy oversight where they allowed people to just buy the points for 10 cents a point and forego any actual buying of Pepsi. They could just buy the points. And so that meant that if you cut this whole thing down, 7 million Pepsi points is actually only $700,000 for a $32 million military jet.
What did you personally think of John's plan to take advantage of Pepsi not including a disclaimer at the end of their Pepsi points commercial?
I mean, I love it. I love the spirit of this. That I was so drawn to the sort of Spielbergian kind of like Peter Sellers and being there, just innocent quality of this kid where he genuinely felt like these guys were offering this jet and that he was going to go get it. I feel like the spirit of this whole thing and the spirit of John Leonard is just something to be celebrated, because had this sweepstakes existed today, there would have been 10 million people on Twitter pulling their points to go get that jet, and it would have just been democratized in a way that would have been so exciting and fun, and Pepsi never would have done it. You know, it just never would have happened. So I just love the fact that at this point in time, when you couldn't pull together the rest of the world, you had to go about this completely on your own. And I just feel like that's something to be celebrated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. Exactly. That perseverance and the tenacity. Why do you think John was so obsessed? He was obsessed with this and working on it for a few years. Why was he so obsessed with this idea of getting a free Harrier jet from Pepsi?
Well, you know, I think that now that I know John pretty well, I think that he's just like a thinker.
I remember somehow getting in touch with a spokesperson for the Pentagon. It was like Kevin Bacon or Ken Bacon. It was Kevin Bacon was from Footloose. But
let's dance!
I could only imagine what he was thinking, somebody calling him to see whether or not you could buy a Harrier jet. And essentially what I got was that, yes, you could, but it couldn't have all the armaments on it. That was something that would make it, quote, illegal. But if you could somehow acquire a Harrier jet and it didn't have the missiles, some of the radar jamming stuff, that there was not a prohibition against it.
He's a little bit of a thinker outside of the box, and he's kind of like thinking about big ideas. And I think at age 20, you know, he's going to community college. He lives in Seattle. It's a small town. I think he was just looking at this as like a big opportunity to sort of expand his universe and be a part of something bigger. And I guess just dream big, to be cheesy. And you know, I think that like knowing him, it doesn't surprise me how tenacious he was and how much he dug in, because there was a lot of steps along the way that normal anyone, you know, in his position would probably just be like, this is kind of not worth it. What am I doing here? This is too much work. And he just never had that attitude. He just always kept digging and going.
How'd everything feel?
Everything feels good, John.
Let me know if your backpack's heavy or something.
Okay, buddy. My backpack's heavy. I'm letting you know.
You have these beautiful, majestic scenes of John and Todd hiking in Antarctica in the present. What challenges did you and your crew face while you were shooting this footage?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was just such an incredible piece of the story. So when we met John and Todd and we were deciding to do this project together, it just was really clear to me that we needed to follow them on the mountain, because the whole foundation of their friendship was on the mountain. It's a great metaphor for this sort of like going up against the big Goliath. You know, it was a great metaphor for that from a visual perspective. And also, there's just not so often now, there's a lot of docs that get made about stories from the past that really just don't have any kind of present day connection. And there's no real connection to like the characters outside of just them in the interviews or in the archival. And so I just love the idea of actually being able to build up their actual friendship by way of this present day plot. And I mean, in terms of challenges, I'd never climbed a mountain like that before in my entire life. Like, we had to go do a couple of qualifying mountains to sort of see if we could actually do it. And my producer and I just sort of like, we loved the idea of the challenge, and we ended up hiring a couple of cinematographers, Renan Ozturk specifically, who's kind of a famous guy in that world. He shot Meru, and he's a bit of a celebrity in the world of mountain climbing, and he came on the trip with us. And really, without him, it probably wouldn't have been possible, because we were pretty green and out of our depths, but we did it. We all got to the top, and it was one of the best experiences of my life.
Congratulations. Besides, put aside the challenges, which you just explained very eloquently, the challenges of shooting in Antarctica, what was the biggest challenge you faced making a four-part docuseries about advertising, lawyers, and the Cola Wars?
I just didn't want to make it dry. You know, I wanted to make sure that at the end of the day, the legal part of this was all about the precedent that it set, the legacy of the legal, of the case itself, not so much about the actual day-to-day legalese and sort of the inner workings of what was going on, because it just wasn't that exciting, frankly. It took place over many years, and, you know, they never actually got to trial. And so I think that the real challenge, I think, was to really dig into the characters and make sure that the characters were the whole point of the show, and that we could follow on a journey that felt relatable, even if we didn't remember the story, or even if we weren't around in the 90s. Just try to make it accessible for everybody in the funnest way possible.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the legacy of this case. What do you think is the legacy of this case between John Leonard and Pepsi?
I mean, one of my favorite parts of this whole process has been, I have not talked to a lawyer yet about anything randomly and brought this up to them and have them not say, I studied this in college, in law school. Huh. Every lawyer studies this case in law school, and it is so much fun to hear that the legacy of this bizarre, absurd case from a 20-year-old kid in the 90s has literally changed advertising law forever. I mean, you certainly will not see a promotional campaign that does not have a disclaimer ever again because of this case.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's very fascinating. Well, what are you working on now?
Yeah, I've got a few projects that I'm kind of developing and trying to figure out what's next. I've got a really exciting one that's about another sort of iconic American brand and the story, the succession story behind that brand, which I'm really excited about. And, you know, the great thing about finishing up this project is, you know, it took a long time, and it was a real long haul. And I'm actually going to India on Saturday just to go away, to take the train from the bottom to the top for, you know, a couple of weeks and unwind. And then I'll figure out what I'm going to do after the new year, I think.
Andrew Renzi, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Pepsi Where's My Jet, and I wish you safe travels throughout India.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.
Andrew Renzi is the director of the Netflix docuseries Pepsi Where's My Jet. You can find out more about Andrew and the series at wpr.org/beta.
There's only one reader you're guaranteed to satisfy as a writer, and that's you. So I'm always trying to make something that I find satisfying, but also I don't want to get in my way of reaching that satisfaction point.
Coming up, Wisconsin's own Wendy Wimmer on her dazzling debut short story collection, Entry Level. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Wendy Wimmer was born and raised in Green Bay, Wisconsin. She's just released her debut short story collection, Entry Level. Former Beta guest Dan Shawn describes Wendy's stories as propulsive, delightfully unpredictable, and utterly addictive. And he's absolutely right. Wendy's stories often veer into the uncanny. Take the opening story, for example. It's called Strange Magic. It takes place at a roller skating rink where the employees discover that they can reverse the aging process. Another story, Texts from Beyond, is about a telemarketing company that communicates with the dead. A recurring theme through all 15 stories in Entry Level is Wendy's focus on characters who are underemployed. She joined us from her home in Green Bay to talk about her process, why the Dairy State is rich with stories, and why she wanted to represent Wisconsin's working class.
I come from a very blue-collar or maybe even no-collar background, where my family was a restaurant family going back on both sides of my maternal lineage. They grew up in restaurants and bars and what they call in northern Wisconsin taverns. In fact, my grandmother and my great-grandmother literally lived in the tavern that they ran. So I heard many, many stories of that. Very much a affinity with being underemployed. And then I said I'd never work in restaurants. And of course I did. But, you know, I later became like a cubicle denizen of a cubicle landscape and, you know, just this massive acres of cubicles, and was doing my graduate work while I was programming a computer for, I just actually looked at my my pension report, and it told me how much I was making. Back then, it was like $22,000 a year I was making, and getting my master's at the same time. In fact, many of the stories are based on, you know, real life experience, or inspired by real life experiences that I had, especially working in the call center, from Text From Beyond. I worked in a call center for 4 years.
Yeah, that's why there's this authenticity in all the stories. And I couldn't help but think, when you mentioned cubicles, I couldn't help think of my fellow Canadian Douglas Copeland's reference. Well, I think he coined the term veal fattening pens. And yes, he's one of the writers who's, you have many writers who you list at the end, and he's one of your favorites, isn't he?
Yes. He very much is. And it's interesting because when I first started working at the company where I was coding, we didn't even get whole cubicles. We just had like a line of desks. So it reminded me very much of cow stanchions. If you're, you know, grew up in a rural background with all the butts facing out toward the aisle, that was us. We had like no privacy. We just had like these little half walls. So it was very kind of impersonal and almost dehumanizing in so many ways. I'm delighted to see it resonates with a lot of people, you know, even people, some people who were my coworkers were at the book launch back then. And they were like, oh, I was hoping this was about the help desk. So that was an exciting experience to have.
That's great. Yeah, definitely. One reviewer has described your characters as damaged people. Do you see them that way?
I think that life is really difficult to get out without a little bit of damage. So I think of them as imperfect as we all are, and oftentimes damaged by the universe that is maybe predatory or at best disregards them. But I also see them as having hope. You know, they're being strong, they're surviving, they're finding a way to make it work, even though the system is kind of against them. You know, we have, I think about Grace, who's dealing with her, you know, being responsible for the care of an aging parent who is ill and not being able to get any support from the system because her insurance isn't enough to cover the care for her mother, but she's also got to work.
Yeah, that's a great description. I love that description, imperfect as we all are. I want to ask you about the opening story, Strange Magic. Where did the idea for this story come from?
So when I was a child, this is one of the few locations that's actually named for the real place. There was a roller skating rink in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and my parents had to work during the day on Saturdays, again, working in restaurants and service industry. And my stepfather's sister was 15 or 16, and she worked at the roller arena. And that was like her job. That was her Saturday job. She was a kid. And my mom would say, hey, do you want to be babysat by Aunt Mary? And she would then just drop me off at the roller arena. I don't even know if she gave me money to go in, because she just assumed that this 15-year-old kid was going to like sneak me into the roller skating rink and then also babysit me. And I thought it was great because it meant I got to spend all day roller skating. So that was the inspiration. When Mary Ellen's left breast grew back on its own during our Saturday dinner break, we had confirmation that something weird was happening. It was between shifts at the roller arena. A private Cub Scout party had just left, and our Saturday night late skate didn't open for another 2 hours. Wasted skate was our little staff secret. 2 hours to kill and a 24-pack of Old Milwaukee, because these days we weren't likely to party after closing down and were more likely to collapse a lung trying to hurdle the mop bucket like we used to 20 years back. Roll Arena was a legit place in Green Bay. It just closed down not too long ago when the owner retired. And I just have so many memories of the songs. And I remember when I was a little kid, You know, there was a song Wildfire, which is a terrible song, by the way. But it is about like a horse that runs away and it somehow a killing frost kills it, which doesn't even really make sense because killing frosts like kill your tomatoes. It doesn't kill, an actual stallion. And I used to always want them to play that song and ABBA's Dancing Queen, because like when I was zooming around the skating rink, it just felt like I was a little bit like I was flying. So I think that's where the inspiration for that story came from. She ran calling wildfire,
calling wildfire. It's such an intriguing idea, and just I was just so in awe of just how you paid attention to all the details. Like, for instance, you got to roller skate counterclockwise. That works. If you skate clockwise, that doesn't work. The disco ball needed to be spinning, and it's not clear if the laser beams have any effect. And it's just such a compelling idea. And I'm wondering if you could kind of walk, or should I say skate us through the creative process of writing Strange Magic?
Absolutely. I was attending a workshop or a writer's conference, actually from another guest of Beta, Dan Sean, was running it. And he leads a very kind of organic and almost like a, subconscious level of story origination that he was taught by Linda Berry, another Wisconsin resident. And it involves like starting with a word and coming up with the images that flood your mind with that word. And then from that image that you get, further fleshing it out and further developing it. And one of the words, I think the word that I used was sweat. And I remember thinking about the difference between like the clean sweat when I was a teenager of, you know, especially roller skating. I used to roller skate a lot. And that was the kernel of the story. And as we fleshed that out, I could hear like the soundtrack of a roller skating rink, you know, the various sounds that you hear, the wheels kind of going over the rink, the actual music that's involved, which of course plays a huge part Strange Magic, which by the way, the original name for that was Skate Queen. We changed it because I wanted to bring in more to that connection of the music that's playing with the Moog synthesizers, and that is a callback to ELO.
That's a great title. And you nailed the music playlist. Like it was great. It was so great just how you did that.
And thank
it's
you.
It's just such a great story. Many of your stories include weird, kind of uncanny, almost supernatural elements. How do you decide which stories to include these elements in and which stories not to include them in? Is it just kind of the process of writing through them, or do you know in advance?
I think the story decides. In fact, I absolutely do not know in advance. In fact, there's a story in the collection that's set on a cruise ship called Bacerity. And in that story, originally, the story I intended to write had talking marine animals in it. And by the time I got to the end of the story, that's not the story it was. It was, there was no place for them. The story ended before the talking marine animals showed up, so it needed to end there. And sometimes this sounds very kind of hokey and hippie, but it's about the story deciding how it fits in the world. If I try to take the wheel and drive it, you get a lot of kind of feeling forced, and it's not in some ways pleasing. Also, it's kind of like the difference between when somebody makes you a salad versus when you create your own salad, and somehow that salad doesn't taste as good as if somebody else makes the salad. If you kind of like sit back and just find out what happens as a writer, it's much more satisfying to you. And of course, there's only one reader you're guaranteed to satisfy as a writer, and that's you. So I'm always trying to make something that I find satisfying, but also I don't want to get in my way of reaching that satisfaction point.
Mm-hmm. And the thing I've learned from talking to so many writers is so many of them say, and it sounds like it's true of you, that if you know what the ending of the story is, then you don't want to write it because there's no magic, there's no surprise for you.
Yeah. Well, very much so. And I care a lot about endings, especially. And sometimes the ending already forms itself. Sometimes the ending is about, the ending is there. I know that scene. And the discovery process is finding out, how did I get here? How did that happen? So, for instance, in Where She Went and Car People, those two stories, I had the last image when I started. That was the beginning of the process for me. I knew where it was going, but I had no idea how it got there, and I had to find that out.
Your writing style has been described as innovative, darkly humorous, wry, and whimsical. I'm curious about how you would describe your writing style.
I would describe it as scary, funny, sad, like with slashes. Yeah. And actually, Dan and I were talking about our styles, and that's what we both kind of landed on. That is, I find that there's so much humor in these odd moments, and yet there's also so much sadness in funny moments in some ways, and everything's a little uncertain. So a little scariness is, I'm a little spooked by things that most people aren't spooked by. And then I'm also not spooked by things that other people are spooked by. So I find that incredibly interesting to kind of situate myself in that kind of axes between those three spaces.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us examples of things that you're spooked by that other people aren't?
Like those jumpy sock wind guys in front of
cars. Oh yeah.
Those are most terrifying things I've ever seen. I am so freaked out by that.
Yeah. I love the way you use a name as a verb in your stories. For example, go all Camus about the futility of the situation and trying to Sherlock my way through the litany of human ailments. Is this something you do in everyday conversations?
Totally.
Do you?
Totally. Uh-huh.
Can you give us an example of what you would say? Because you haven't said anything, you haven't used it yet in the interview.
Well, I will say that I must do it so frequently that my husband the other day was drinking a coffee and then he said, "Oh, I just Wendy'd my shirt." which made me feel really great about my own ability to, drink without spilling on myself.
Yeah.
and we have a friend who's very pedantic. And so often, we'll make a joke about, we're going to Scott up this situation.
Yeah. You had the chance to talk to my fellow Canadian Margaret Atwood a while back about a pandemic novel you were working on. Would you mind sharing the conversation you had with her, with us?
Absolutely. We were talking a lot about migratory birds for most of the conversation, because I didn't want to be like that person who was, had this great treasure of a living author in their car and is like, "So can you tell me about how to get past writer's block?" I didn't want to be that person. So we ended up talking a lot about migratory bird patterns and Canada geese. And then it turned into a conversation about, she said, "So tell me," after a while, maybe I had earned her trust or I hadn't killed us yet in the car.
maybe both.
And she said, "So tell me a little bit about your work." And I had also, instead of bringing her one of her more popular or famous novels to sign, I had her sign Interviews with the Dead. Which is her craft novel. So she was like, "Okay, what's going on with you?" And so I talked to her a little bit about the pandemic. And this was way before the pandemic. And at the time I was struggling with the fact that, and this is a bigger issue that I'm having with my work right now, is that my novel has essentially gone from being speculative to not at all speculative. But at the time, I was really dealing with the fact that a lot of the things that I was writing about in the novel was people were like, that would never happen. And she said everything in her novels that she has called, speculative fiction and everything, nothing was speculative. Nothing was out of the ordinary. Every single thing had happened. So as long as I based it in authenticity and reality, I could be as speculative as I wanted without fear of it being unbelievable.
Yeah. Wendy Wimmer, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Entry Level. It's an awesome collection, and I can't wait to read your novels.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been fun.
Wendy Wildfire Wimmer is the author of the short story collection entry level. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Michael Imperioli, Andrew Renzi, and Wendy Wimmer. Beta is available to follow on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating and comment or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
When your time comes, you either step up or you start looking for a new career.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Next time you see my face, show some respect.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Is that him? With the sombrero on? Sure.